Today's guest is internationally known homeopath, Dr. Paul Herskew. I have also had the privilege of interviewing his lovely wife on the podcast, Dr. Amy Rothenberg, so be sure to check out episode 142 if you haven't already. Amy and Paul met when they were training to become naturopathic doctors. They both graduated in 1986 and they founded the New England School of Homeopathy together in 1990, which is still running today, and it has trained up thousands of homeopaths over the years. Paul is the author of one of my most used books in clinic, The Homeopathic Treatment of Children, Pediatric Constitutional Types. And I'm sure most homeopaths listening to this episode will have a copy of this book on their shelves as well. He also has a book called See the World and two other books on provings. What really piqued my interest is a book of his that I've actually only just discovered called Stramonium with an introduction to analysis using cycles and segments. And cycles and segments is a method which was designed by Paul and Amy, and it offers a practical way of organizing and analyzing information in the case histories of our patients, as well as details which appear in our remedy descriptions. And this approach allows for an integrated study of homeopathy without the cumbersome memorization of long lists of individual symptoms. And this is something that NESH, the New England School of Homeopathy, actually trains their homeopaths in. And I am really excited to learn more about this because as a homeopath, we are so inundated with different prescribing methods, different remedies, different ways of taking and analyzing a case. So to have a system that makes this whole process so much more easier and streamlined is really very exciting. So I'm so glad to have had this chat with Paul today, and I'm really excited to learn more about cycles and segments myself. If you want to learn more about this as well, and you want to find out more about Paul or Amy or their books or the amazing work that they're doing in the field of homeopathy, visit www.nesh.com. That's the New England School of Homeopathy.com. Thanks for listening.
Welcome to the Homeopathy Hangout, where we discuss all things homeopathy from around the world. And now my mum and your host, Eugenie Kruger.
Hello, homies, and a very warm welcome to Homeopathy Hangout. Today, we get to hang out with the lovely Paul Herskew on the show. Welcome, Paul.
Thank you so much, and thank you for having me.
It's a pleasure. I've had your beautiful wife, Amy Rothenberg, on as well. So it's really special to get to have you on as well. Tell us a little bit, Paul. This is the first question I ask everybody on the show. How were you first introduced to homeopathy?
Ah, okay. I was in university and I was actually studying to become an invasive cardiologist. That was like my path was not just cardiology, but invasive cardiology. And I went on a bicycle trip in the springtime. It was a very rainy day. And in the midst of that rain, I hit like a little pebble and I fell. The bike got wrecked. I was almost in a pretty bad accident. Anyway, that night I had 104 fever, maybe 105. It was very high. And the next day I sort of recovered, tried to figure out how to fix my bike. Eventually ended up back home. And then 6 days later, I woke up and I had arthritis in every joint of my body. So it took me forever to be able to get up and get dressed and go to my local doctor who said, don't worry, this will go away in 6 months or so. And just then my sister called me and said, have you ever heard of homeopathy? And I said, well, not really. And a good friend of mine had just come back from England and said, have you ever heard about homeopathy? So that's kind of unusual. That was within half an hour of each other. And there was going to be a homeopath speaking at Columbia University in the evening. So I went to meet a homeopath. It was a local homeopath, and he was talking about health and disease, and that in general, disease and disease symptoms don't come out of the blue. There's a reason they come in. There's a sort of method to them, a method of health and progression of disease. And really, he was describing Herring's Law at a rudimentary level, but it was just the most beautiful thing. I think I started to weep. It was just so beautiful. And because there was multiple questions at that time, I was trying to deal with this arthritis thing that I'd never had before. And then my best friend had scoliosis. He's a dentist, but at that time he was in university with me. He had scoliosis and he had to be in this sort of tube, essentially, to raise him up. And my friend, whose father was the head of the medical school, she would get drunk every month because of the menstrual pains she was having. And a friend of mine had, you know, mononucleosis. My parents had hypertension. You know, there's, I was looking around, I was thinking, boy, I can become a doctor and absolutely help no one I know, no one I love. And then there was this sort of homeopathy thing. So I went to see this homeopath who gave me a remedy. And then in just a couple of days, I was just like, not just the arthritis went away, but all this energy. I just had a ton of energy and I was so clear. And I don't remember being like that in years and years. And then a few weeks later, I sort of bounced back into his office. I was telling him, I feel terrific. I just rattled off everything, how I was feeling. And he said, all right, let me give you some more of this. And he gave me some more of this. And then within an hour, I'm like throwing up and I felt horrible. And it took me like 9 months to sort of sort myself out. But during that, soon after feeling the horrible, during that first couple of days, I thought, wow, I'm going to do this for the rest of my life, because anything that makes me feel that good and that bad, it's really good. And it helped me not just in this sort of local symptom, but it helped me in general. So this was before there was homeopathy really in the United States. It was hard to find any homeopaths. There was this one person. And eventually I found a homeopathy book, and it happened to be Kent's Materia Medica. And it was like fantastic. I mean, it's just, so I'm like reading it over and over and over. And then eventually I found the repertoire. I was like, oh my God, this is so much easier, you know? And then eventually I found Borman. Eventually I found Hahnemann. And, but it was hard to find these books. They just, and I was living in New York City, mind you.
Wow.
Yeah, it was sort of like a mystery back then. And just, I studied and just read any book I can. And eventually, and mind you, I'm 20 at this point, right? So there was this summer school that was, it was a 2-week summer school called, it was Millersville, it was the National Center for Homeopathy. Mm-hmm. I think this was like in 1981 or so. So I'm a kid, but it's only a doctor's course. So everybody's like 30, 40, 50, 60. So I convinced somebody to write a letter for me to let me in. So they let me in. And at that point, I started teaching some of the people because I've been studying so much. And anyway, that's how it all began.
Wow.
Long short story. And so then when I was at Millersville at the National Center, I started interviewing one professional after another. So I went through a medical doctor and I said, all right, why should I go to medical school if I want to be a homeopath? Then I went to an acupuncturist. Why should I be in? And I kind of went one by one. And then when I got to a naturopathic physician, he said, that's because Hahnemann was really a naturopath at heart. He was all about homeopathy and nutrition, psychotherapy, hydrotherapy, and so on. It is the finest match that you can have. And I really liked that, and it kind of matched what my thinking was. So in the United States, we have naturopathic physicians, just like you do in Australia. The naturopathic physicians in the United States can function as primary care physicians. So we deliver babies, we sign birth certificates, we sign death certificates. In some of the states, they prescribe any medication, they do surgery and so on. Very different than the type you have in Australia.
We don't have that at all here. I wish we did. It would be life-changing for so many families.
Well, you'd be able to have the best of natural medicine. And when you need something different, then you can have that.
Is that something that you can get what we call like bulk bill? Or can your private health insurance obviously pay for a consultation like that? And does it subsidize some of the medicines that you get?
Yeah, so medicine in the United States is regulated state by state, and the insurance companies are regulated state by state. So you, where are you located?
I'm in Perth, so on the west.
Yes, you're in the west.
Most isolated city in the world, apparently.
Right. So Western Australia would have their own medical insurance and their own medical laws. And then New South Wales would have their own insurance and their own medical. That's kind of how it goes. In the United States, if you're below a certain level, then you can get free basic medical insurance. And then above that, you can buy insurance. I'd say most insurance in the states that license natural medicine will cover it to one extent or another. Sometimes 100%, sometimes 50%, sometimes 0%. It depends.
It's actually so heartbreaking. We had a lot of 16 different natural health modalities ability to be able to claim from the private health insurance was taken away from us on the 1st of April, April Fool's Day, 2019. So it's just really heartbreaking because it makes it unaffordable for some people that, you know, used to be able to use their private health.
Yeah. So in this is the case in a lot of countries where you really need to show both efficacy and cost efficacy. Mm. And for a lot of natural medicines, you have really good practitioners, but lousy people, researchers. Mm-hmm. We have really excellent researchers, but lousy practitioners. And it's hard to sort of match up everything. And so what comes out is essentially politics and dollars and cents. And they say, this is just not worth it because we should get rid of this because it's costing the national government an extra $100 a year or some ridiculous amount, considering how much they spend otherwise. Mm-hmm. In fact, 25 years ago or so, Harvard Business School did a study in my practice, and what they showed is the average person that was not flying but driving was driving about 4 or 5 hours to get there, and this is how much they spend in their annual medical budget, which they spend out of their own pocket, compared to another, like a similar kind of individual, same age, same gender, same everything, they would spend this much. And so what they're able to show is that actually we are quite cost saving.
Oh, that's really interesting.
Even in the circumstances where they're paying out of pocket, it saved them as much money as, I mean, it saved them a lot. And that's not even counting the days missing work, which in the United States, a lot of times is not covered. But even when it is covered, the business is still losing that money. And so there's like a lot of ways you can show that good natural medicine can be quite cost savings. Mm. You just have to do good studies.
How did that study come about, the Harvard Business School? Did you approach them? Did they approach you? Or what? I'm just interested because this discussion is coming up more about how we need a really good study that we can show. I was interviewing Dr. Asiyaga the other day, and he was saying we need, like, especially a really big, well-constructed asthma study with, you know, a few thousand cases. And because we know homeopathy has such great success with asthma, and it can be so costly with, you know, preventers and all of these. So how did that study come about?
So I live in a few universes in terms of my main interest. My very main interest in my working world is trying to find the right treatment for the right person at the right dose at the right time. What I use primarily as a modality is homeopathy, but sometimes it can't be homeopathy. So for example, I look particularly tired right now because I hadn't slept through since yesterday because, want to hear a story?
Yes, please. This is what today is all about.
Right. So I don't know who your many people in your podcast, who your listeners are.
50% homeopaths, 50% home users. We've done a survey.
Got it. Okay. So I have a patient in India who is an older gentleman, and I see him when he's in his 60s and he has some mild kidney disease, some mild prostate problems. He's has some cognitive decline. He has a mild heart failure. I treat him, doesn't matter with what, but chronically, and basically everything improves. And then after a while, things start coming back. I treat him again. Things improve. Now he's in his 70s. Cognitive decline comes back. And these other things, I treat him. Things get better. So it's been a while since I see him. Now he's in his mid-80s. And the reason they're calling me is because he's in acute heart failure, which you can measure by something called BNP, which is 7,000, which is like you die at these numbers in the near future. And he's in the middle of gallbladder attack, and he's got sepsis. So he's choose what you're going to die from. He's so septic. He's got such the white blood cells are 30,000 and it's like 99% neutrophils. So this is like a really bad infection. Mm. He's got a really high fever and he's in a delirious state. Mm. They need to do an operation to fix the gallbladder because when you image the gallbladder, there's like stones everywhere and his blood work is looking terrible. They can't do an operation because he's on blood thinner. So no operation, he dies. Operation, he dies. So you're like kind of stuck in this sort of weird situation of what to do. And so they stop the blood thinners. And really what they need to do is buy time. But they couldn't figure out how to buy time because you need the blood thinner to sort of wash out of the system. So I gave him, on the homeopathy side, I gave him CarboVeg because that's the picture that matched at that time and the cardiac symptoms abated. And then I gave him chelidonium because that was the symptoms that became most prominent. And he would take chelidonium, the fever would drop, the blood work would improve, the pain would diminish, and then a few hours it would increase again. So it would give him that, it would decrease. And we sort of basically buying time this way. And after a few days, they can do the operation. They do the operation. The gallbladder is just decimated. It's just necrotic tissue. Yeah. And so basically, he's doing fine, by the way. But nobody was sleeping during this whole thing. And he's in a fine older gentleman and fine doctors in India, but he was basically going to die. And so this is one of the ways that homeopathy can be used in. Obviously, it could be used in a lot of different ways. It could be used in the home as a home aid for people. It could be used in chronic conditions. It could be used in acutes. It could be used in severe acutes. It could be used in life-threatening situations. It could be used in incurable situations where you need, when you're buying time. Mm. This is one of those circumstances.
And so, end stage of life is something I don't think we talk about enough, you know, like
separately using homeopathy as an end stage of life, not just sort of extending life, which is not the end all or be all, but actually extending it with clarity of mind so that end of life, instead of being sort of drugged up and completely out of it, you can sort of be conscious. Want to hear a story?
Yes, please. I'm all about the stories.
So one of my students who eventually became really a good friend, I love this man. He was one of the smartest doctors I've ever met, internist. Anyway, he had cancer and cancer had spread everywhere. And so I started treating him. And in the midst of that, he decided that he wanted to come off his opioids, off the drugs that he was knocking himself out because he's in so much pain. So in the midst of it, I saw him in the middle of this sort of withdrawal, and he actually fit the remedy Ignatia. It doesn't matter why, but I'm just trying to get to the point. So I give him Ignatia, and everything just sort of, that whole withdrawal thing just stopped. And from being addicted to this drug to not being addicted to the drug, not needing it, not having any more withdrawal, was like hours. It was the sort of the craziest situation. And for him, even though I loved him, he was he had a dark part to him, as we all know people that have, you know, they encompass a wide variety of in their lives. So he was sort of, he had a dark side to it. And for him, death was going to be sort of burning and destruction and carry on living off his, you know, just, it was this sort of dark syphilitic thing. And anyway, so in treatment with him, and this is all palliative because it's the cancer sort of everywhere. And instead of dying, you know, in the next short time, he died quite a bit longer. But instead of it being sort of this dark thing, he sort of was conscious and he started calling all his friends and people he knew and people that hurt him or he hurt over the decades. And just was making good with everybody. And in a week before he died, he got married. And you know, anyway, so there's the wedding. And then the wedding night, he's playing the piano for everybody as each one of them is saying goodbye. And then everybody left. And it was me and his bride. We were just spending the night together. And that night, he went into the hospital. So he's in the hospital, and we're dealing with the situation as it is. And then he like apparently just dies. You know, just everything, all the machines go off, he dies, and his wife is like hysterical crying, and I'm stoic. I guess that's the, you know, and he like sits up.
Oh, no.
says, you know, I'm not dead yet. And he dies. And so the last thing was this sort of joke, and we're like all laughing and crying, and that was a good death. That was a good death from where he was, addicted and dark, and this death is such a scary, horrible, you know, it's homeopathy has a role there.
It really does. I've interviewed two homeopaths now who are also death doulas, and I'm getting really excited by the fact that people are starting to see even death as a natural process. And actually, just last week, one of my staff's chickens were on the way out, and she said, I'm going to take it to the vet to euthanize it. I'm like, no, death is actually just a natural process. Just keep her at home. Give her some arsenicum. Give her some cuddles and just be there with her. Like, it's not something, you know, we've medicalized birth so much and pregnancy, and we medicalize death so much as well. And I think homeopathy actually has a powerful place in that. And your story is brilliant because there is just no way he could have gone on to call all these people and play piano and have a wedding while he was high on opioids. You know, how different would that picture have been?
And not just that, but, you know, even if he suggested, hey, do you want to make peace with your family or something?
Yeah.
Just, no, they're all jerks or they're all, you know.
Yeah.
But I've had different family members, patients of family members, some of my patients whose family gone through horrible things, and each time I think, wow, this is why I became a homeopath. This alone was worth it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I have so many other questions from things that you've already mentioned. I'm just trying to think where to start. One of them is, you know, this gentleman in India that you treated in his 60s and then through 70s and then 80s. Was somebody like you, you know, I've had homeopaths on the show here that have had 30, 40, you know, 50 years experience. And the thing that always fascinates me is just the journey. Like, you know, walking that path with your clients over such a long period of time, but also the learning that happens over such a long period of time. I've only got 10 years under my belt. And if I look at where I am now as a person and as a practitioner versus where I was 10 years ago, it's so wildly different. So I can only imagine if you've got 20, 30 or 40 years under your belt, what has that journey been like for you? If you had to kind of like sum it up somehow, walking that journey with your patients, but also the learning that's happened and your thinking, that's how that's all changed over the years. Sorry, we need a whole podcast episode.
I'll sum that up in 2 minutes. I had a guiding light, I guess, which was that I really wanted to describe what happens in reality in the clinic, in the patients. And so that was like my guiding light. And if you kind of read that first book that I wrote, it reads as if it was the patient sitting in front of you. It reads like, oh, this is exactly what they're like. And so it was sort of interesting to read a lot. And as I said before we started today, my main guide has been these books that mm-hmm. I surround myself with. So by the time I went to naturopathic school, it was my first month in naturopathic school, and you're supposed to start seeing patients in your third year just to observe, not to do anything. But I was sort of into the homeopathy part pretty deep by that time. So I'm studying in the library. I'm just sitting in the library, and one of the doctors and a fourth year student said, we have a problem in one of the clinics in that this woman has this severe kidney pain. And she's passing a kidney stone. And we tried this and this and this and this. Didn't really work out so well. The ambulance is coming. It's not going to be a good story for our school. But we kind of heard that you're really into homeopathy. So I was like, okay. Mind you, I have like long hair at that point. Because I wasn't prepared to go to see anybody. I was like, I might have had like a torn t-shirt on or something. So I go into this clinic and I open the door. I tell this story, but I've written about it. And there's this woman in the most excruciating pain I've ever seen. And mind you, I'm a kid. I've never seen anybody in pain. So she's like screaming and crying. Her daughter who's sitting there screaming and crying. The whole thing is sort of a mess. And I asked her a question. After I stopped I mean, I'm shaking inside, you know. And so I ask her a question. She can't answer. And I asked her a second question. I pushed like in her inner thigh. And I was like, does this hurt? And she started screaming and threw up. So I was like, okay, I'm going to give you this remedy. And then eventually when we ended up giving her Berberis, which is not it's a good prescription for somebody that needs Berberis. And so it goes in her mouth and she's like, wow, that was it. And then half an hour, she's walking home.
No.
And so her life changed markedly from that dose. But for me, even though it was the first time I saw somebody in pain, actually, it was the first time I saw somebody with kidney stones and kidney pain. For me, it was almost like my 100th or my 500th patient with kidney pain, because I'd read this case and this case and this case and this case. And I saw kind of like, well, this doesn't make sense. And this makes sense. And this doesn't make sense. So finally, when I saw her, it just helped confirm what I was thinking. And that kind of led me to a path that I just never deviated from. I just know what people say, but what matters is what the patient shows me and what is right there, where the books are right, where the books are wrong, and just let the patient dictate the reality for me. And so that hasn't veered. That hasn't veered. So that led to, so mind you, this is early and mid 1980s. There isn't a lot of books in the United States. There aren't a lot of books in homeopathy. I couldn't find anything about children, but where we moved to, it was all just, every family had many kids. It's not like where I live now, but in the Midwest, lots of families, lots and lots of kids. Mm. So I'm treating a lot of kids, and there's just not a lot of information. So it's hit or miss, trying this and that. And over time, I start realizing, okay, this is what this remedy actually looks like, and this is what this remedy looks like. And so I thought, okay, let me put my thoughts together. And my colleagues were asking me, well, won't you come here and help me with this case and this case? Forget the cases, help me with my kid. And, and so that eventually led to that first book of me saying, you know, I can't just keep on flying around. It makes more sense to just put this in book form. And I try to make it as the language as plain text as possible. So that, you know, somebody with basically an eighth grade level of education can read this and say, okay, I understand.
That book has helped me so much in my practice. I think I've said to you that the cover has actually come off now because I've just used it so much. I have one complaint about that. It's just that there's not you need to have more remedies added on there, because once you've read that, the children's pediatric homeopathic book that you've written, the picture is so clear and the details in it is so great that, you know, it's helped me so much in my prescribing. I can't even tell you, because I only treat women and children, but you need to write another one with more remedies.
Yeah. So
no pressure, but need at least another 50 or 100.
Right. So what that led to is me teaching a fair amount, and I had a choice of how to go about teaching. What I decided is I really want to work with not a million people, but just go deeper into education with each of the individuals that I work with. And so basically I wrote this book, and lots of people are treating lots of kids now and getting the sort of the remedies for pretty well. And then there's a whole host of people, a whole host of kids that aren't getting better. So now I'm seeing a lot of those kids. That this puts me at around 1993 or so, 1994. So I'm seeing a lot of kids and with all kinds of neurological and difficult disorders. And I have a fair amount of experience with those kids. And so I'm starting to teach those, but it's hard to sit down and write it. So what I start to write is the experience that I see, which now leads to the sort of concept of cycles and segments. Is it okay if we just sort of
please talk about that? Yes, yeah. Please talk about cycles, okay, and segments. Yeah.
So initially, when people are studying homeopathy, they might hear this concept of layers, and that somebody used to need calcarea carbonica, and now they need lycopodium or whatever the remedies are. And it almost seems like a sandwich, like here's this level, then here's the next one, then here's the next one. In fact, that does not describe the vast majority of reality. What most people that need, let's say they need calcarea carbonica, and then they never got calcarea carbonica, and some big stress happened, and they moved to tuberculinum, or they moved to sermonium, what have you. They'll have those symptoms of sermonium or tuberculinum, and they'll keep a lot of the symptoms of calcarea carbonica. So there's a lot of symptoms that fit one remedy, and then a lot of symptoms that fit another remedy. And how do you decide? And what happens over practice? And what I start seeing is a lot of cases from my homeopathic colleagues that seemed like they needed this remedy, but they weren't responding to it. Or they seemed like they needed that remedy. And so what that led to is a few different, I would say, uncovering something rather than creating something. I uncovered sort of a understanding that as people, let's say they need a nosode, and it doesn't matter which nosode, they'll have a lot of symptoms of that nosode, but they'll also have a lot of symptoms of the polycrest. Mm-hmm. And then it's like a question that the homeopath has, well, should I give them this nosode, should I give them this polycrest? If they need a remedy like stramonium, a book that I wrote mm-hmm. about, they'll have a lot of symptoms of stramonium, and every person that needs stramonium will have a lot of symptoms of tuberculinum, and a lot of symptoms of metaranum, and a lot of symptoms of sulfur, and so on. And it becomes sort of messy.
That's where I'm at my clinic at the moment.
So that messiness, you said you're in your 10th year?
Yeah.
So this is the sort of the hook in homeopathy is in your first few years, you just get a lot of polycrest. A lot of people are sort of on the healthier side, and they need calcarea, they need sulfur, they need this and that. And then as you practice longer and longer, you just start getting more and more difficult cases. I don't mean just difficult in the pathology, but difficult in the presentation of the patient. And so what I uncovered really is this thing that I call the map of hierarchy, which is described. You can look it up. If you type in map of hierarchy and my name, you'll see different articles that reference it. And there's several chapters within that sermonium book. So the sermonium is a whole book in itself because it's the first remedy that sort of opens up the unconscious to a whole set of remedies that are violent and tangible remedies like hyoscyamus and stramonium, torrential and mercury and so on. And what was interesting, so now it's 1994, 1995. I remember I flew to Norway and I'm describing the materia medica of children that need veratrum album, children that need hyoscyamus, children that need mancinella and tarantula. Mm. And, you know, there's like a couple hundred people, a lot of them have been practicing homeopathy for a while. And somebody raises their hands and they say, Americans must be crazy because we don't see these remedies. We don't give veratrum album and tarantula and remedies like this. We don't see this. But what they were reading is old books, and what they were being lectured is materia medica that sort of describes an extreme form of each of the remedies. Mm. And a lot of times of somebody that needs tarantula, veratrum album, mancinella, and so on, would come into the office, and while they would have symptoms of veratrum album or tarantula or hyoscyamus, they would also have the food cravings of calcarea carbonica and the fears of lycopodium and the keynotes of metarhinum and the homeopath would be prescribing these other remedies. And what I said to them is, do me a favor, just listen to these lectures, and then let the chips fall where they may. And I came back the next year and I said, so how many of you have given these remedies? And everybody raised their hands. And it's like, because just like you said in the first book, it sort of described what is typical for these remedies presentation wise. My lecture on those remedies presented what they're really like today.
And then also in real life language, I think that's the big thing, because if you're just reading the materia medica, especially if it's older materia medica, you know, the words that they use and the things that they did then, just it's not always transferable. And so when you're reading a materia, like a book like yours, where it's saying, this is the kid that will come up to your desk and take a pen off your table, or that will touch everything in your clinic, and like that sort of stuff. And then you see it and it's like, oh, okay, you know, I can understand that now. So I don't know if maybe it's a lazy way that I prescribe, but I really like books like yours. Actually, Franz Kuss's children's book I really enjoy as well, because it just shows you exactly what it's going to look like in your clinic. So you can see that child. It's like they become a person to you, and you can relate it to an actual case in your clinic, and it makes it so much easier to remember.
So I'm speaking here primarily to the people that are using homeopathy at home, but the homeopaths should also listen to this. In a lot of ways, homeopathy exists, continues to exist, not because of the homeopaths, but because of the public demand for homeopathy. And what's interesting to me is that if you look, and I guess this is a long way of answering your question, why Harvard Business School? But
it all makes sense in the end.
I live within the world of science, and I hold sort of a center part where there's homeopathy and what we call complementary medicine on one hand, and pretty deep science on the other hand. And I try to hold that middle ground. So I have pretty good conversations with some pretty deep scientists and homeopaths. And what's interesting, when you look back and just take the 30,000 foot look, the language of homeopathy is the language of the people, right? So instead of how the language of medicine has transformed to be sort of Latin. And you go to a medical doctor and you say, I have an ear pain because I have an ear infection. And they say, oh, no, you have otitis media.
I know, that always cracks me up.
So intuitively, people at home naturally gravitate towards homeopathy because we speak in the language of the people. This is a strength of homeopathy. And when the homeopath is eliciting symptoms and the homeopath is talking to the patient, the patient's parents and so on about why they're giving this remedy for this thing, it's within the language of disease and language of health. And it's intuitively, it makes sense. So this is a strength of homeopathy. I think one of the tricky things in not just in homeopathy, but in medicine in general, is trying to understand where that sweet spot is between people you should be treating at home and people you should not be treating at home. And the caveat that when you talk to legislators, and which I do, which when you talk to scientists and physicians, is people that are not trained in the art of medicine obviously don't know what they don't know. And so I think a useful thing for people that are wanting to take care of their families and themselves, a useful thing is just to learn as much as they can about not just the health part, but how the body functions, how the body works. And the more they know about that, the better that answer is of where, what should I treat, what should I not treat. And I say this not just for the parents, but it's also for health professionals that I have taught many people, and I hear a lot of different stories. During COVID, I treated, not only was I, you know, one of the first people to treat COVID outside, but yeah, I don't know if you remember the Diamond Princess, the boat that had the initial people outside of China that this COVID started in China, right? And it maybe it starts in November, December of 2019. In December of 2019, I wrote already, something's going on in China that's not right. By January, I was like, we have a problem here. By late January, you know, then the it becomes more known. By February, describing how this is actually the one that is going to be quite serious. And one of the things that we used was this boat that had a fair number of people that got sick with COVID. So I had patients on that boat. So I'm kind of seeing this right from the get-go. And, you know, I know homeopaths that said there's no such thing as COVID that died. I know homeopaths that said COVID exists, but it's not a big deal that died. I know homeopaths, and these are not like theoretical homeopaths. These are people I know. I know homeopaths that said, we can easily take care of this. It's not a big deal that died. And then I know a lot of people that said, you know, that had a sort of public statement about homeopathy and COVID and then got really sick, and I treated them and they kept their public story, even though it's opposite to what their personal experiences were.
It's very interesting because, you know, and
I'd love to talk about COVID as a whole thing at some point.
Whole separate podcast, yeah.
Yeah, because in a lot of ways, Australia missed the worst of it in terms of the infection itself.
I feel we did as well, especially here in Western Australia. I do feel we came off very lightly.
Yeah. The easiest math you can do, this is just the easiest math you can do, is take the population of wherever you are, divided by 300, and that's how many people died from COVID, 1 in 300 people. And if you look around the world, that's the magic number. If you look at the island nations, Australia, New Zealand, Iceland, it's 1 in 1,000, 1 in 1,400. So like when I treat a fair number of people in India, and every single family I treat had multiple members die from COVID. So it's just like the craziest thing. And by the time the island nations relaxed their laws, we had a different COVID, essentially. It had mutated. So I think you're fortunate. But I was wondering about that
because I was kind of feeling it would have been better to be exposed to that, because I think it's all about susceptibility, but also you should be exposed to it at some stage. I feel like I'm the only person on the planet that never got COVID, and my family didn't either. I suspect my son might have had it. He had a vomiting bug for 24 hours and a bit of a fever. I don't know if that was COVID. He never had a cough or anything else, but we never did any rat tests or anything anyway. So I do think we came off very lightly over here, because my family in South Africa, on my husband's side and my side, there were some serious illnesses over there and consequences and a couple of deaths, not his direct family, but yeah, it was definitely, South Africa got it pretty bad as well.
Yeah. So I'm working with different physicians through this, and not only am I working with, you know, homeopaths, but I'm working in their families, and I'm working with the physicians that are in the emergency rooms and urgent cares that are taking care of COVID patients. And in that first instance, in that sort of, and everybody's like trying to ask the same question, when should I worry? When should I not? What should I do? So that question of when do I treat in the home and when is it like serious, that thing, it's something that should be talked about more, because it should give comfort to both families and patients and so on when they take care of things themselves, when they should call and talk to their homeopaths or talk to their clinicians, and when should they go to the emergency room and so on. That is, should be done better.
Do you think that comes with experience? Because I know for a fact that I actually refer out more now than when I first started, which really it should have. I think I maybe had that gung-ho, you know, blissful ignorance when I first started practicing, whereas now where I've seen where things can lead, now I actually refer out more, and things where I previously would have just said, oh yeah, I can help you, now I'm like, no, go to your doctor, just go get a diagnosis and we'll go from there. So I'm much more careful now.
Yeah, you know, I think it's also true that it's possible that as you're practicing more, you start to see more complex issues and more difficult situations. So I think for the parents and the public that is using homeopathy, I think it's fantastic. I think this is, in general, health should be a partnership between how you take care of yourself and your family. And then when you need somebody to go beyond that, then you see that person, and when they need somebody to go beyond that, they refer you to somebody else, and so on and so on. So that should be done better, and that should be done better around the world. It's not like it's different in Australia than in America. And then for the homeopaths that are, do you have a specific question you'd like to ask? Just on the
Well, I do have some things I kind of want to wrap up. Like, we've had so many interesting conversations. I actually feel with any of the homeopaths I have on the show, I always feel like I have instant resonance with them, more so than any other, you know, we've never met in real life, Paul. I've only ever read your books, never met before, but I just felt like I know you from the second that we started chatting. And I find that with so many of my guests. And I think it's just that, you know, we kind of we have the same, similar beliefs and similar ways that we view the world. Maybe that's a good way to put it. So I always feel it doesn't really matter what we talk about. It's just going to be fun for the listeners anyway and the homeopaths. But one of the things I wanted to just loop back on was the business school and just how you got that funding. And then I was also wanted to loop back because you mentioned about that naturopathic training. And I was also wondering, do you think that is a bit of a fall that we have in homeopathy, that we don't spend enough time on that naturopathic training? You know, like we just get trained in homeopathy. We don't get trained in nutrition or anything like that, unless you go to a school that teaches that. So do you think that's a bit of a fall down for us? And then also the cycles and segments, I want to ask you so much more about that. I definitely want to talk more about COVID, but we and the COVID vaccination. I just want to say to the homeopaths that are listening that have asked me to have a chat with you about that, we're going to do a whole separate episode because there is so much to uncover in all of that. So we've got lots of ends that we still have to tie up. So you can't go anywhere for at least the next 10 minutes.
Right. Okay. So cycles and segments, all of that is its own. We should talk about that as well. The issue, as you go through the map of hierarchy, the issue that we come to is this idea that some remedies, like I use hundreds of remedies pretty regularly, but most homeopaths don't get a chance to use a lot of them because they're either waiting for this sort of key symptom that never shows up, or they get sort of stuck with those other remedies that I was describing, that you still see keynotes of this remedy, this remedy, this remedy. And so how do you get to understand what the remedy is really about? What's driving that remedy and the symptoms that drive that remedy? How do you fix the problems of the repertory? So the repertory has some remedies that are in 20,000 rubrics and some remedies that are in 50 rubrics. So how do you balance that out? How do you balance out the inaccuracies in the repertory? How do you fix all of that? So that's, we sort of came up with a way to sort of, it's like a Gordian knot. You just sort of fix all of it at one time. So that's the second segment approach.
And the best way to learn about that, I know you've got the Stramonium book, which I actually just, we've got the Aurum Project here in Australia. It's basically our only homeopathic book supplier. I found a copy of Stramonium Cycles and Segments yesterday. So I'm really excited about that. It's going to be here probably next week. So that's a good place to learn about it. Where else can homeopaths learn about this? Do you teach that at your school?
Yes. So the school we started in 1990, so it's the oldest school in homeopathy that's been going, is the New England School of Homeopathy, and you can look it up online. And we have done these courses, sort of in-depth courses, going through, as you said, are there other remedies? Yeah, we talk over 100-something remedies, pretty in-depth, and not just sort of what the books say, but this is kind of what it looks like in practice. This is how you use this
remedy.
And we go through just pretty much all the homeopathy at a practitioner level. There's a whole other course that's sort of like a 12-hour course that's just an introduction to the concepts of classical homeopathy. And then we teach a lot of classes, but we only teach it to people that took that big course. And so we go pretty deep with people that we go deep with. And most of the classes, therefore, not open to just everybody, because it became difficult to just answer the same question over and over, because then I never get a chance to go to the next remedies. So New England School of Homeopathy, that's the home base. And the other question you asked was, so Harvard Business School. I treat a fair number of people that are Olympiads and the CEOs of different corporations and education folks from different walks of life, including people from all the different schools. Harvard is an hour and a half that way. Yale is an hour and a half that way.
Oh, wow.
And so it's not unusual for those kinds of individuals to intersect with our clinic. I also helped pass the law for naturopathy and therefore homeopathy in Massachusetts. Massachusetts is a state kind of like New South Wales and Australia. And I'm the chair of that board. So it's like anything that involves science and homeopathy in Massachusetts, I'm sort of involved in the midst of that. But I dovetail with a lot of different scientists on a lot of different projects. If you look at PubMed, there's some of the, so I've written hundreds of articles besides the bunch of different books, but the articles in homeopathy, most of them are in the regular sort of non-peer
mainstream.
Yeah. And the ones that are sort of mainstream, it's not in homeopathy. Mm-hmm. It's other non-homeopathic science, medical things. But it comes back to what I'm really interested in, trying to find the right drug, the right treatment for the right individual at the right time, whether it's trying to figure out who's likely to get a side effect from this drug so that they can not be on that drug. It's the same issue, just trying to personalize medicine truly. So yeah, I love this.
Amazing. There was something else I was going to ask you. You know that initial really good response you had to that first remedy that you were prescribed, and then you had another dose, and then, you know,
same remedy.
Yeah. That's something I've witnessed. I actually had that with my son. I took him to see a homeopath. He's 11. I took him to a homeopath for the first time a few months ago, because I've just always just self-prescribed. But then he's just hit 11 and, you know, teenage hormones are starting to come out. I'm like, yep, you need to go somewhere else. You're not my sweet little baby boy anymore. But that first dose, she gave him plutonium nitricum. And that next morning, I heard a sound, because he's always really hard to get up in the morning. You have to tell him 50 times to get ready, go brush his teeth, pack his lunch. I woke up and he was in the kitchen dressed, making his lunch. I'd almost fell over backwards. I have never seen anything like this in my life, but he's never done it since. It's so annoying. And often in clinic, we find this, we give a remedy for a baby, you know, who hasn't slept in months, and then suddenly they sleep all night and the client calls you like, oh, you've cured my baby. And then the next night it just relapses. So you give the same remedy, but it never has that same staying power. And even I've found if I go up a potency, because, you know, the next thing would be to maybe dose a little bit more, go up a potency, or it is just doesn't have that same hit. Sorry, I know this is a whole other topic I'm opening here, but what's your thoughts on that?
Yeah, so we actually spend a full weekend, like a full module on the whole follow-up and all the ins and outs of it. So it actually takes a couple of days to answer that one, but there, okay. There is an answer. It's just it's like a sort of logical way to sort of proceed through it, because otherwise it just sounds
superficial. Yeah.
But it is not an unusual incident that you described.
I guess so. We're going to have several follow-up episodes.
When you had Amy on the call previously, did she talk to you about Australia at all? And our kids played Ultimate Frisbee. Ultimate Frisbee. Cool. Yeah,
it's one of those sports.
And they played pretty well. Two of them represented the United States.
No way.
And the other one represented the United States when she was older. Every so often, there would be the international meeting would be in the United States, and Australia would bring their team, and they always stayed at our house.
Are you serious? That is so cool.
The Australia men's team. So we always had a fondness for it.
Well, you guys are a very, very fun family, because, I mean, you and Amy with your ballroom dancing as well, and your kids play Ultimate Frisbee. It sounds very fun at your house.
Yeah. So we have three kids. You have two. Kids are in the next generation up, so they're 30 to mid-30s. And
I'm not brave enough for a third. I just couldn't do it. I keep saying to my husband, this is no way. And my mother-in-law, if she wants to get me really angry, I love her to bits. If she wants to make me angry, she'll ask me, when's the third coming? And I'm just like, I'm not brave enough for a third one.
Well, so we have 3 and 3.5 years. So the second and the third one are really close to each other, like 13 months. And as he says it when he meets me, yeah, I was the accident.
Oh, that's happy. Well, I always, you know, when parents come into the clinic and they say, oh, that child was an accident, I'm like, it's only an accident for you. Like that child, that soul planned to be here.
Yep. He's an assistant coach in the NBA, which is the professional basketball
team. What? Yes. That is so cool. Yeah.
Crazy.
Before we go, you just have to tell me the story of how you and Amy met, because she never told us that one.
Okay, so we end up in the same naturopathic school. Amy's story is a little bit different. Maybe she shared it. She was, you know, science, but her parents died early from what we would call preventable diseases at this point. And she moved to Portland to work in a medical center. And at that time, she was living with naturopathic medical students. And she just loved what they did. So that's how she was like, I'm going to do that. I'm not going to go to that medical school. I'm going to go to that medical school. So that's how she got into it. I got into it the way I described. We were in the same class. It's a small class. It was like 50 people or so. And then I was describing homeopathy because I was pretty deep in it. And she said something like, that is the stupidest thing I've ever heard. So anyway, by the fourth year, I proposed and crazy, she said yes. So,
amazing.
But yeah, we're in the same class.
And the ballroom dancing, when did you start doing that?
So three kids, the third kid left. And so I said to Amy, you know, I'm getting my bucket list out. And she was like, what's a bucket list? Are you kidding me?
Did she not watch the movie?
She doesn't watch the movie. So, which is kind of, she doesn't watch movies. She really just doesn't like the medium, which is kind of ironic because she treats a lot of the A-list Hollywood people. Which is kind of funny because this incredibly famous person will show up and she'll say, hi, and what do you do? And they're like, you don't know me? And they're like, no, should I? Which is like fantastic because finally they could just be like real people. And you know, so they enjoy her, she enjoys them. And then it's kind of crazy. I work mostly with sort of the politicians. We sort of, our life is a little different that way. So she said, all right, what's on your bucket list? I said, well, first thing is I want to learn how to fly. And we have like a tiny, tiny airport near our house, almost like a grass airport. You just take off and tiny little land, learn. I like flying. So I thought, all right, I should get a license. And she said something like, you know, I'm never getting in a plane with you. You know that, right? And I was like, come on, I could take you to like Martha's Vineyard and we could just have a hamburger and come back. She's like, no, I'm never getting in a plane with you. What's next on your bucket list? So, well, I always wanted to learn how to ballroom dance. Not like, you know, those people with the numbers and what's called social.
My grandma
ball.
Did that.
Yeah, not that. But sort of social ballroom. You hear a song and you like ask somebody to dance and you just do all these sort of dances. And she was like, yeah, I'm into that. Aww. So we started with that. So it wasn't that long ago. It was 8 years ago, 9 years ago. But we took it very seriously. We, you know, hours a day and just sort of took it methodically. And yeah, loved it.
I think that's such a beautiful thing for couples to do. I think divorce rates would go down if more couples danced together. Such a beautiful thing to do.
Or did anything together. It's true. Yeah.
True. Yeah. Paul, I could literally talk to you, not just all day, but days and days and weeks. It was so wonderful to have this time with you. I would love to have you back for several more episodes because we have mountains of more topics to cover. Sure. I know our listeners are going to be really enjoying our conversation today. Thank you so much for your time. And do you quickly just want to tell our listeners the places that they can get hold of your books and also your school as well?
So just if you Google my name, or I don't know, am I allowed to say Google? If you do a search for my name and just books, you'll see quite a few books. And then if you go to PubMed, you'll see the peer-reviewed journals. And then if you just type my name, you'll see just lots of articles all over the place. If you go to our website, which is the New England School of Homeopathy, or www.nesh.com, it's a very, very robust website. Lots of articles all over the place and lots of information there. You can dig very deep into a lot of free stuff. And then you can read about classes that we teach.
Amazing. Thank you so much.
Okay. Thank you so much.